Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, we'll hear another selection from the writings of Mark Twain, read by Tom Bacon.
This is taken from the manuscript of A Tramp Abroad, written in 1879. Twain called it The French and the Comanches. Now, as to cruelty, savagery, and the spirit of massacre, these do not add a grace to the world's partly civilized races, yet at the same time, they can hardly be called defects. They grow naturally out of the social system. The system could not be perfect without them. It's hard to draw a line here with any great degree of exactness between the French, the Comanches, and the several other nations existing upon the same moral and social level. It must in candor be admitted that at one point the Comanches rank higher than the French in that they do not fight among themselves, whereas a favorite pastime with the French from time immemorial has been the burning and slaughtering of each other. No weapon has drunk such rivers of French blood as the French sword. No hatred has been so implacable as the Frenchman's hatred of his brother. No other creature's religion has wrought such marvels of murderous atrocity as the meek and lowly religion of the Frenchman. However, the last sentence is in a sense unfair in the present comparison, since the Comanche has had no religion, and hence no pressing motive to reform his brother by killing him. The Turks have fought among themselves sometimes, so have many others among the inferior nations, but in truth, civil war has never reached the entire perfection of bitterness, effectiveness, and immoral activity and perseverance in any but two communal organizations, those of the French and of the Kilkenny Cats. I very much doubt if the French are more cruel than the Comanches. I think they're only more ingenious in their methods. If this can be established as a fact, it will be evidence that the Frenchman is a higher being than the Comanche. The French nobility invented several striking and remarkable customs and preserved them through the intelligent docility of the people for 1,000 years. One was the right, after renting a farm to a man, to ride down the man's crops in chase after game without having to pay for the destruction caused. Another right was to forbid the man to enclose his farm with walls or fences to keep out predatory wild animals, for fences obstructed the chase. Another was the lord's right to keep a dovecote and not have to pay for the crops which the doves ate up, yet be free to punish any victim who killed one of the creatures. Another was the lord's right to keep an oven and a mill and compel the commoner to take his baking and grinding there and pay double price. Another was the lord's right to seize the lands and goods of widows and orphans when the head of the family died intestate. Another was the lord's right to take about a fifth part of the sale money when lands within his jurisdiction changed hands. But these are minor cruelties. Any partly civilized community could invent them and endure them. Higher in the scale are these others, namely, the lord's right to make the peasants, after working all day, sit up and whip the ponds all night with boughs to prevent the frogs' music from disturbing my lord's slumbers. The lord's right to cut open a peasant and warm his feet in him as in a foot muff when the chase had wearied my lord and made him cold. The Comanches might beat these last three rights, possibly, but they could not beat them much. However, French ingenuity struck its supremest altitude during the Revolution, when the revolutionists tied naked men to naked women and threw them in the river. This was a step beyond the invention of the Comanche. Therefore, here the Comanche fails, and the Frenchman takes the precedence. As this thing occurred less than 100 years ago, we're able to believe that the Frenchman has not yet lost his inventive art, or possibly the disposition to exercise it. In one thing, the French stand almost alone. The spirit of massacre seems to be theirs by divine right. No other nation has it so conspicuously. The French have almost monopolized it during ages. Long before St. Bartholomew's, they had learned to know and love the deep pleasures of the massacre. St. Bartholomew's is so monumental that its vast shadow hides the noble array of massacres that lie behind it. We see them so dimly that we scarcely note them, but they're there just the same. If certain of the greater ones had been done in England, they would blacken the sun of her history like an eclipse. But being done in the native home of the massacre, they seem as natural and proper as splotches on a leper. and provoke as little attention. St. Bartholomew's was unquestionably the finest thing of the kind ever devised and accomplished in the world. All the best people took a hand in it, the king and the queen mother included. The time was 1572. There was a misunderstanding on a religious point. The Frenchman is nothing if not pious. He's not content to be pious all by himself. He requires his neighbor to be pious also, otherwise he'll kill him and make him so. Yes, if that neighbor declines to lead a holy life, he'll take an axe and convert him. The Frenchman is a social being and does not wish to occupy heaven in solitude. Therefore, he provides company for himself. At the time I speak of, it was not merely one neighbor who had gone astray as to religion, but a full half of the nation. This was bad business. The Catholic chiefs were grieved to see this sorrowful sinfulness, and they took counsel concerning the best way to cure it. The Queen Mother, whose wisdom and holiness were perfect, suggested the usual national remedy, a massacre. The idea was approved, and the massacre was ordered, just as other people would order a breakfast. The midnight between two August days was appointed for the beginning of the good work, and notice was sent out to the various towns and cities. The truly pious prepared their arms, preserved their secrets, and waited. They visited, and were visited by, their sinful and unsuspecting neighbors as usual, and the doom that was in the air gave no token. The king held the kindliest communion with the leader of the sinners, and if this latter had been of an observant turn, he could have seen there the very gun with which His Majesty was going to cripple him from the palace windows a little later. The appointed hour came. The midnight tocsin burst upon the stillness with its clangor. The pious were ready. The sinful were taken by surprise. Houses were invaded. Men and women were slaughtered in their chambers or on their stairs. Children were brained against the walls. The devout work was kept up 2 days and three nights. The river was clogged with the bodies of the slain. The streets were piled with corpses. The air was foul with the decaying flesh of men who were martyrs in their own slowness of invention. For they were Frenchmen, and if they had happened to think of the idea first, they would have massacred the others. 70,000 lives were taken in those 2 or 3 days in France, and the true religion retired from its exploits so much strengthened that the other side was never able to seriously threaten its supremacy afterward. There have been other French massacres since, of course. The Reign of Terror was one protracted and enjoyable one, and we've had some in our time, notably that of the 2nd December and several under the Commune toward the close of the Franco-Prussian War, but none of those are half such matters of pride to the French as their peerless St. Bartholomew's. The most attractive feature of the French national character, and its most encouraging one to the missionary, is its admirable and unapproachable docility. We look upon rabbits as being meek, but what is the meekness of the rabbit to the meekness of the Frenchman? Are there any rabbits that would allow themselves to be abused, insulted, and trodden underfoot persistently and continuously for 1,000 years and never offer to bite? Europe is freckled all over with daring little communities which have risen against powerful oppressors time and again and compelled redress. That list stretches out to weariness. William Tell's and Wat Tyler's have been common nearly everywhere but in France. Yet even France rose at last and would have retired to its war and again quite contented with a cuff and a bonbon, if the foolish king had offered them. But it was not his style to do the needful thing at the needful time, so the chance went by. Then the nation cast its rabbit skin and put on its other national garment, the tiger skin. Being closely pressed by Europe in arms, it went a step further and asserted its manhood, and was doubtless surprised to find out how much it had of it. Napoleon, the great foreigner, brought the people's soldiership up to the last summit of perfection, and when he got ready, he dressed the nations in their rabbit skins again and put his foot upon their necks, and they glorified him for it. Napoleon III accommodated them in the same way to their vast satisfaction. The foreigner has been a great boon to France. France's great men have been rather usually foreign-born. The present time is not an exception to the rule, and these wise persons seem to have well understood how to please the average citizen. The average citizen requires glory, That is the main thing. Plenty of glory, plenty of noise, plenty of show, plenty of equality and fraternity, plenty of masked balls and fantastic nonsense, plenty of gammon and brag, plenty of assurances that the world's eye is upon him, that his wife sets the fashion in clothes, that he is skin-deep in politeness, plenty of reminders that his tongue is the court language of the nations, and that Paris is the sun and could robe the earth in intellectual darkness by going out. Plenty of vive la République today, vive le roi tomorrow, vive la commune next day, and vive the devil the day after. Plenty of high-sounding, painless duels to cock up his stricken honor again. Plenty of piousness and indecency and massacre and hurrah. These he requires in life, and a rattling funeral to end up with a priest and a lantern in the lead, an imitation major general on the hearse box, and a string of vacant mourning coaches tagging after. Then he is satisfied, and sails rejoicing up among the other angels to tell about it. These grandeurs are inexpensive, and the great foreigners who have ruled France have found their profit in furnishing them. As I've said, the Frenchman's docility is the most beautiful trait in the national character and will presently become his most useful endowment, for by it, our missionaries will uplift him as one lifts a rabbit by the ears. The Frenchman is made up of the littlest littlenesses conceivable and the greatest greatnesses. The tiger that is in him, the stealthy, blood-loving, massacring instinct, fits him to become, through repression and careful training, the mightiest of soldiers. The rabbit docility, which has been bred in him by ages of meek putting up with wrongs and indignities, is the thing which will enable him to endure this oppression and training without a murmur. His gigantic vanity will move him to attempt miracles in art, mechanics, statesmanship, and literature which will appall others, and his fervid and frantic imagination and his restless energy and diligence will enable him to carry them to a successful conclusion. Now, if my work has been intelligibly done, I've shown that the Frenchman is, in some respects, the superior of the Chinaman, in others, the equal of the Turk and the Dahomian, and in hardly any particular, the conspicuous inferior of the Comanche. I hoped and believed I could do this. I think I've succeeded. There's little question in my mind that France is entitled to a distinguished place among the partly civilized peoples of our globe. I have the highest hopes for France. I have the deepest and most heartfelt yearnings for her moral and intellectual elevation and enlightenment. But I know and feel that this great benefit cannot come to her in perfection through the restricted and unsystemized efforts of our American colony, active and holy and precious as these are. Nope, there is but one way. The employment of a trained corps of lay American missionaries, furnished with the ribbon of the Legion of Honor to render them inconspicuous and avert notice and jealousy, and paid by the government out of appropriations created by a special tax. Let us all aid in helping the Frenchman. Let us take to our hearts this disparaged and depreciated link between man and the simian and raise him up to brotherhood with us. From Twain's first full-length book called Roughing It comes this story. He titled it Lost in the Snow. We mounted and started. The snow lay so deep on the ground that there was no sign of a road perceptible, and the snowfall was so thick that we could not see more than 100 yards ahead, else we could have guided our course by the mountain ranges. The case looked dubious, but Ohlendorf said his instinct was as sensitive as any compass, and that he could strike a beeline for Carson City and never diverge from it. He said that if he were to straggle a single point out of the true line, his instinct would assail him like an outraged conscience. Consequently, we dropped into his wake, happy and content. For half an hour, we poked along warily enough, but at the end of that time, we came across a fresh trail, and Ohlendorf shouted proudly, "I knew I was as dead certain as a compass, boys. Here we are, right in somebody's tracks that'll hunt the way for us without any trouble. Let's hurry up and join company with the party." So we put the horses into as much of a trot as the deep snow would allow, and before long it was evident we were gaining on our predecessors, for the tracks grew more distinct. We hurried along, and at the end of an hour the tracks still looked newer and fresher, but what surprised us was that the number of travelers in advance of us seemed to be steadily increasing. We wondered how so large a party came to be traveling at such a time and in such a solitude. Somebody suggested that it must be a company of soldiers from the fort, so we accepted that solution and jogged along a little faster still, for they could not be far off now. But the track still multiplied, and we began to think that the platoon of soldiers was miraculously expanding into a regiment. Baloo said they had already increased to 500. Presently he stopped his horse and said, "Boys, these are our own tracks, and we've actually been circussing round and round in a circle for more than 2 hours out here in this blind desert. By George, this is perfectly hydraulic." Then the old man waxed wroth and abusive. He called Ohlendorf all manner of hard names, said he never saw such a lurid fool as he was, and ended with the particularly venomous opinion that he did not know as much as a logarithm. We certainly had been following our own tracks. Ohlendorf and his metal compass were in disgrace from that moment. After all our hard travel, here we were on the bank of a stream again, with the inn beyond dimly outlined through the driving snowfall. While we were considering what to do, the young Swede landed from the canoe and took his pedestrian way Carsonwards, singing his same tiresome song about his sister and his brother and "Ye child in the grave with its mother," and in a short minute faded and disappeared into the white oblivion. He was never heard of again. He no doubt got bewildered and lost, and fatigue delivered him over to sleep, and sleep betrayed him to death. Possibly he followed our treacherous tracks till he became exhausted and dropped. Presently the overland stage forded the now fast receding stream and started toward Carson on its first trip since the flood came. We hesitated no longer now, but took up our march in its wake and trotted merrily along, for we had good confidence in the driver's bump of locality. But our horses were no match for the fresh stage team. We were soon left out of sight, but it was no matter, for we had the deep ruts the wheels made for a guide. By this time it was 3 in the afternoon, and consequently it was not very long before night came, and not with a lingering twilight, but with a sudden shutting down like a cellar door, as is its habit in that country. The snowfall was still as thick as ever, and of course we could not see more than 15 steps before us, but all about us the white glare of the snowbed enabled us to discern the smooth sugarloaf mounds made by the covered sagebrushes, and just in front of us 2 faint grooves which we knew were the steadily filling and slowly disappearing wheel tracks. Now those sagebrushes were just about all the same height, 3 or 4 feet. They stood just about 7 feet apart all over that vast desert. Each of them was a mere snow mound now. In any direction that you proceeded, the same as in a well-laid-out orchard, you would find yourself moving down a distinctly defined avenue with a row of these snow mounds on either side of it. An avenue, the customary width of a road, nice and level in its breadth, and rising at the sides in the most natural way by reason of the mounds. But we had not thought of this. Then imagine the chilly thrill that shot through us when it finally occurred to us far in the night that since the last faint trace of the wheel tracks had long ago been buried from sight, we might now be wandering down a mere sagebrush avenue miles away from the road and diverging farther and farther away from it all the time. Having a cake of ice slip down one's back is placid comfort compared to that. There was a sudden leap and stir of blood that had been asleep for an hour, and a sudden arousing of all the drowsing activities in our minds and bodies. We were alive and awake at once, and shaking and quaking with consternation, too. There was an instant halting and dismounting, a bending low, and an anxious scanning of the roadbed. Useless, of course, for if a faint depression could not be discerned from an altitude of 4 or 5 feet above it, it certainly could not be with one's nose nearly against it. We seemed to be in a road, but there was no proof. We tested this by walking off in different directions. The regular snow mounds and the regular avenues between them convinced each man that he had found the true road and that the others had found only false ones. Plainly, the situation was desperate. We were cold and stiff and the horses were tired. We decided to build a sagebrush fire and camp out till morning. That was wise, because if we were wandering from the right road and the snowstorm continued another day, our case would be the next thing to hopeless if we kept on. All agreed that a campfire was what would come nearest to saving us now, so we set about building it. We could find no matches, so we tried to make shift with the pistols. Not a man in the party had ever tried to do such a thing before, but not a man in the party doubted that it could be done and without any trouble, because every man in the party had read about it in books many a time and had just naturally come to believe it. With trusting simplicity, just as he had long ago accepted and believed that that other common book fraud about Indians and lost hunters making a fire by rubbing two dry sticks together. We huddled together on our knees in deep snow, and the horses put their noses together and bowed their patient heads over us, while the feathery flakes eddied down and turned us into a group of white statuary. We proceeded with the momentous experiment. We broke twigs from a sage bush and piled them on a little cleared place in the shelter of our bodies. In the course of 10 or 15 minutes, all was ready, and then, while conversation ceased and our pulses beat low with anxious suspense, Ohlendorf applied his revolver, pulled the trigger, and blew the pile clear out of the county. It was the flattest failure that ever was. This was distressing, but it paled before a greater horror. The horses were gone. I had been appointed to hold the bridles, but in my absorbing anxiety over the pistol experiment, I had unconsciously dropped them, and the released animals had walked off in the storm. It was useless to try to follow them, for their footfalls made no sound, and one could pass within 2 yards of the creatures and never see them. We gave up without an effort at recovering them, and cursed the lying books that said horses would stay by their masters for protection and companionship in a distressful time like ours. We were miserable enough before. We felt still more forlorn now. Patiently, but with blighted hope, we broke more sticks and piled them, and once more the Prussian shot them into annihilation. Plainly, to light a fire with a pistol was an art requiring practice and experience, and the middle of a desert at midnight in a snowstorm was not a good place or time for the acquiring of the accomplishment. We gave it up, tried the other. Each man took a couple of sticks and fell to chafing them together, and at the end of a half hour we were thoroughly chilled, and so were the sticks. We bitterly execrated the Indians, the hunters, and the books that had betrayed us with a silly device, and wondered dismally what was to be done next. At this critical moment, Mr. Ballou fished out 4 matches from the rubbish of an overlooked pocket. To have found 4 gold bars would have seemed poor and cheap good luck compared to this. One cannot think how good a match looks under such circumstances, or how lovable and precious and sacredly beautiful to the eye. This time we gathered the sticks with high hopes, and when Mr. Ballou prepared to light the first match, there was an amount of interest centered upon him that pages of writing could not describe. The match burnt hopefully for a moment, and then went out. It could not have carried more regret with it if it had been a human life. The next match simply flashed and died. The wind puffed the third one out just as it was on the imminent verge of success. We gathered together closer than ever and developed a solicitude that was rapt and painful as Mr. Ballou scratched our last hope on his leg. It lit, burned blue and sickly, and then budded into robust flame. Shading it with his hands, the old gentleman bent gradually down, and every heart went with him, everybody too, for that matter, and blood and breath stood still. The flame touched the sticks at last, took gradual hold upon them, hesitated, took a stronger hold, hesitated again, held its breath 5 heartbreaking seconds, and then gave a sort of human gasp and went out. Nobody said a word for several minutes. It was a solemn sort of silence. Even the wind put on a stealthy, sinister quiet and made no more noise than the falling flakes of snow. Finally, a sad-voiced conversation began, and it was soon apparent that in each of our hearts lay the conviction that this was our last night with the living. I had so hoped that I was the only one who felt so. When the others calmly acknowledged their conviction, it sounded like the summons itself. Ohlendorf said, "Brothers, let us die together, and let us go without one hard feeling toward each other. Let us forget and forgive bygones. I know you've felt hard toward me for turning over the canoe and for knowing too much and leading you round and round in the snow, but I meant well. Forgive me. I acknowledge freely that I have had hard feelings against Mr. Ballou for abusing me and calling a logarithm, which is a thing I do not know what, but no doubt a thing considered disgraceful and unbecoming in America, and it's scarcely been out of my mind and has hurt me a great deal. But let it go. I forgive Mr. Ballou with all my heart." And poor Ohlendorf broke down and the tears came. He was not alone either, for I was crying too, and so was Mr. Ballou. Ohlendorf got his voice again and forgave me for the things I had done and said. Then he got out his bottle of whiskey and said that whether he lived or died, he would never touch another drop. He said he had given up all hope of life, and though ill prepared, was ready to submit humbly to his fate, that he wished he could be spared a little longer, not for any selfish reason, but to make a thorough reform of his character, and by devoting himself to helping the poor, nursing the sick, and pleading with the people to guard themselves against the evils of intemperance, make his life a beneficent example to the young, and lay it down at last with a precious reflection that it had not been lived in vain. He ended by saying that his reform should begin at this moment, even here in the presence of death, since no longer time was to be vouchsafed wherein to prosecute it to men's help and benefit, and with that, he threw away the bottle of whiskey. Mr. Ballou made remarks of similar purport and began the reform he could not live to continue by throwing away the ancient pack of cards that had solaced our captivity during the flood and made it bearable. He said that he never gambled, but was still satisfied that the meddling with cards in any way was immoral and injurious, and that no man could be wholly pure and blemishless without eschewing them. And therefore, continued he, in doing this act, I already feel more in sympathy with that spiritual saturnalia necessary to entire and obsolete reform. These rolling syllables touched him as no intelligible eloquence could have done, and the old man sobbed with a mournfulness not unmingled with satisfaction. My own remarks were in the same tenor as those of my comrades, and I knew that the feelings that prompted them were heartfelt and sincere. We were all sincere and all deeply moved and earnest, for we were in the presence of death and without hope. Threw away my pipe, and in doing it felt that at last I was free of a hated vice and one that had ridden me like a tyrant all my days. Yet while I talked, the thought of the good I might have done in the world and the greater good I might now do, with these new incentives and higher and better aims to guide me, if only I could be spared a few years longer, overcame me. And the tears came again. We put our arms about each other's necks and awaited the warning drowsiness that precedes death by freezing. It came stealing over us presently, and then we bade each other a last farewell. A delicious dreaminess wrought its web about my yielding senses, while the snowflakes wove a winding sheet around my conquered body. Oblivion came. The battle of life was done. I do not know how long I was in a state of forgetfulness, but it seemed an age. A vague consciousness grew upon me by degrees, and then came a gathering anguish of pain in my limbs and through all my body. I shuddered. The thought flitted through my brain, "This is death. This is the hereafter." Then came a white upheaval at my side, and a voice said with bitterness, "Will some gentleman be so good as to kick me behind?" It was Baloo. At least it was a tousled snow image in a sitting posture with Baloo's voice. I rose up, and there in the gray dawn, not 15 steps from us, were the frame buildings of a stage station, and under the shed stood our still saddled and bridled horses. An arch snowdrift now broke up, and Ohlendorf emerged from it, and the three of us sat and stared at the houses without speaking a word. We really had nothing to say. We were like the profane man who could not do the subject justice. The whole situation was so painfully ridiculous and humiliating that words were tame, and we didn't know where to commence anyhow. The joy in our hearts at our deliverance was poisoned, well nigh dissipated indeed. We presently began to grow pettish by degrees and sullen, then angry at each other, angry at ourselves, angry at everything in general. We moodily dusted the snow from our clothes and, in unsociable single file, plowed our way to the horses, unsaddled them, and sought shelter in the station. I have scarcely exaggerated a detail of this curious and absurd adventure. It occurred almost exactly as I've stated it. We actually went into camp in a snowdrift, in a desert, at midnight, in a storm, forlorn and hopeless, within 15 steps of a comfortable inn. For 2 hours we sat apart in the station and ruminated in disgust. The mystery was gone now, and it was plain enough why the horses had deserted us. Without a doubt, they were under that shed a quarter of a minute after they left us, and they must have overheard and enjoyed all our confessions and lamentations. After breakfast, we felt better, and the zest of life soon came back. The world looked bright again, and existence was as dear to us as ever. Presently, an uneasiness came over me, grew upon me, assailed me without ceasing. Alas, my regeneration was not complete. I wanted to smoke. I resisted with all my strength, but the flesh was weak. I wandered away alone and wrestled with myself an hour. I recall my promise of reform and preached to myself persuasively, upbraidingly, exhaustively. But it was all in vain. I shortly found myself sneaking among the snowdrifts, hunting for my pipe. I discovered it after a considerable search and crept away to hide myself and enjoy it. I remained behind the barn a good while, asking myself how I would feel if my braver, stronger, truer comrades should catch me in my degradation. At last I lit the pipe, and no human being can feel meaner and baser than I did then. I was ashamed of being in my own pitiful company. Still dreading discovery, I felt that perhaps the further side of the barn would be somewhat safer, so I turned the corner, and as I turned the one corner smoking, Ohlendorf turned the other with the bottle to his lips, and between us sat unconscious Baloo, deep in a game of solitaire with the old greasy cards. I've been reading just two of many short stories from Mark Twain, still available in many anthologies. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. Executive producer for the series is Vern Windham. I'm Tom Bacon.